Thomas Jefferson's inkwell, Lincoln's presidential seal and leather portfolio, Teddy Roosevelt's horse saddle, artifacts you can see at a new presidential exhibit opening this weekend in West Branch. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, a visit to the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch for a tour of an exhibit featuring oil paintings and artifacts that belonged to our U.S. presidents. Museum Director Tom Schwartz is our guide. He'll tell us about some of the unique items and the stories behind them. First, this news. It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we're on the road in West Branch, Iowa, at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, where in addition to the permanent exhibits that they have here on Herbert Hoover, of course, we have an exhibit, American Presidents, Life Portraits, that features original oil portraits of each president by artist Chris Fagan. Also, original artifacts from each of the presidents that have been collected for this exhibit. So we'll see some really interesting things. Teddy Roosevelt's horse saddle, Barack Obama's chess set, George H.W. Bush's cowboy boots with golf cleats. Just a few of the things to mention here. And standing outside of the Presidential Museum here in West Branch, well, we're going to go inside, and a special part of this exhibit is they have recreated the entrance to the White House so that visitors will enter on a red carpet into the White House. Let's walk the red carpet. In we go. And standing here at the entrance to meet us is the director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, Tom Schwartz. Good to see you again.
Hi, Ben.
Hi, great to see you.
We'll use the back entrance and...
So, Tom Schwartz, here we are at the entrance to this exhibit, American Presidents, Life Portraits, and you've recreated the entrance to the White House so that visitors are entering on a red carpet to the White House. I feel honored. Thank you.
Well, we did that for a reason. We want people to invite them out of the rotunda and to come in and to feel like they're actually having a personal visit with these presidents through time. As you could see, we've got cutouts of George Washington and Herbert Hoover. As you'll see, there are four opportunities for visitors to do selfies with a president in history. And unfortunately, of the four that we selected, Hoover is the shortest. And it wasn't that he was a short man. He was about a little under 5'11", but given that all of the others are over 6 feet.
Right. I'm looking over here, President Hoover there. And then I look at the other side of the entrance here before we go in. We have President Washington here. You're telling me this is the actual size President Washington was?
All of these figures are actual size. So Washington was 6 foot. 2 inches tall. As we go in, we'll see Abraham Lincoln, 6'4" nearly, as he put it.
Okay, so we have at the entrance here, we have Presidents Washington and Hoover. We'll walk on past them into the entrance, through the entrance of this exhibit.
Okay. So here...
We have our current president, President Trump, here to the left.
To greet you, yes. And then you have Abraham Lincoln. So.
Good day, gentlemen. We'll continue on past you to find out about other American presidents.
So as you leave the entrance to the White House, you get into the main gallery. The core are all of the C-SPAN panels, which consists of brief biographies and an overview of the presidency, the highlights of the achievements, as well as a brief biography of the First Lady. And an original oil painting created by Chaz Fagan of each of the There, although we count 45 presidents, there are actually 44 because Grover Cleveland was the only president not to serve consecutive terms. So he's counted twice. And
so actually, when we say Donald Trump is the 45th president, it's not quite right.
If you count
presidencies.
Right.
Presidencies.
So that's why, for example, we only have 44 artifacts because we didn't need to count Cleveland twice, even though he was big enough to be counted twice.
Okay, we 44 or 45, we don't have the time to see all the artifacts. And so please, Tom Schwartz, take us to some of your favorite bar artifacts.
So obviously we got to start at the beginning with George Washington. And this is Washington's personal copy of John Locke's essay concerning human understanding. Both of the volumes are signed by Washington and also include his personal book plate. And what's important about these books from his library is that that whole founding generation was very much influenced by Locke. And the empiricist approach that people are born without any innate understanding and that they learn by experience, but also they are all born free and equal. So when we get to Jefferson, we'll get a more important understanding of Locke's influence. Mm-hmm. That Jefferson expresses in the Declaration. We also have John Adams' family crest. He designed it and he put it in a ring. What's interesting about John Adams is that his son, John Quincy Adams, would later on become the sixth president of the United States. And you'll see this importance with family identity to be carried on from John Adams to John Quincy Adams.
So we did have previous dynasties, not just George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. We had previous families that inhabited the White House.
This was the first. And in fact, when John Adams was representing before the United States became the United States, when it was still fighting the revolution against Great Britain for its independence, John Adams represented the United States abroad in several diplomatic capacities, and he had his son, John Quincy, with him. And then, of course, John Quincy would also serve as an American representative, a diplomat, in several of the European courts, and spoke French, which was the language of all of the European courts at the time. It was a diplomatic language. And so, at least for the 19th century, both John Adams and John Quincy Adams, probably of all of the presidents of that era, knew more about the world than any other president at that time. In the 20th century, of course, the undoubted individual who had traveled the world five times before 1914 was Herbert Hoover.
Right. Let's move on to some more presidents here. Let me remind our listeners that we're taking a tour of an exhibit. It's actually part of a traveling exhibit, maybe, that is been to other museums in the country.
Yes.
But combined with artifacts of each of the 44 presidents here, and we're taking a walk through with the director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, Tom Schwartz. He's good enough to lend us his time and talk about some of these pieces here. This, we've come to an artifact from our third president, Thomas Jefferson.
Yes, and this is so iconic in representing Jefferson because it's an inkwell, a glass inkwell, and a pen. And, of course, Jefferson was the main author of the Declaration of Independence. And that gets us back to John Locke, because when he writes that all men are endowed by their Creator with unalienable rights, you know, among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, with Locke, he used property, but or possessions. But again, this idea of natural law, all individuals being born in the world equally, kind of blank slates, and that creates the aspirations upon which this government's based.
And when we would get in touch with the mindset of the 18th century, this is a new revolutionary idea in the time when what most countries are ruled by kings and queens.
Right, and it replaced the rationalist philosophy that was predominant at the time, where people were born with certain innate understandings of the world. But by everyone coming in the world the same, I mean, it does introduce that aspect of equality, no class differences. You know, people aren't born the superior of anyone else.
Could this have been the inkwell and the pen that was used to compose the Declaration of Independence?
I don't believe so, but if you look at all of these early founding individuals, they were incessant writers, and they kept everything because they also were very much aware of their role in history. They were making history, and so they were going to keep a record of they were writing for history. You know, and so that's why in reading their correspondence, you really don't find a lot of moments where they're unaware of an audience.
Well, from our third president, Thomas Jefferson, let's move on to where are we going next, Tom Schwartz?
So let's go to James Monroe. People might know him for the Monroe Doctrine, but what we have here is a personal snuff box. And again, it represents a behavior that was very popular in culture at that time, essentially taking ground tobacco into fine powder and kind of snorting it.
Right.
But when James Madison, whom he skipped over, his wife Dolly Madison used snuff, as did Andrew Jackson's wife Rachel. And so it was a behavior that was partaken by both men and women at the time.
But smoking of tobacco is also popular at this time.
Yes, very much so. And then, of course, if you're in the backwoods, you chew.
Okay.
Did
we have any presidents who chewed that you know of?
That's a good question. I don't know if Grover Cleveland did or not, because he did have cancer of the jaw, and it was from tobacco products. So, John Quincy Adams, cufflinks. And once again, the cufflinks have a glass enclosure with human hair in them, and the hair is from his parents. Again, that identity with family.
And the hair in the cufflinks is still in those cufflinks.
Yes, it is. Using hair, a lot of times you'll find it framed in pictures, but also in jewelry. Theodore Roosevelt was given a ring that had contained the hair of Abraham Lincoln from John Hay, his Secretary of State, but Hay had been one of Abraham Lincoln's personal secretaries as a young man. So again, it carried with it great significance. Today, it seems kind of creepy, but we still, you know, when
yes, it does.
We still practice, at least I did, when my children were born. Their first haircut. You clip it, you put it in an envelope, and it's somewhere.
Right, and you have a baby book.
Right.
Many of us have a baby book where a first lock of hair is there.
Right,
as
right.
Well. So maybe not so creepy. Okay, so where to now?
Let's skip over in time. We had William Henry Harrison, who had the shortest term in office because he spoke overly long at his inauguration. It was raining. He caught pneumonia, and 30 days later, he was dead. He was the first Whig president of the United States. The Whigs were kind of the forerunners of the Republican Party. His vice president was John Tyler. Now, Tyler didn't really represent any of the Whig values. He was from Virginia. And what we have of John Tyler's is a gaming table. It's very ornate inlay wood, and you could see that it's a threefold, and it opens up to a felt surface to play different card games or dice games or whatever you're going to do. Now, of course, Tyler was a Southerner, slave owner. He pretty much stifled the Whig agenda. And the Whigs were a very unlucky party because their second presidential candidate that they would elect was Zachary Taylor. He lived maybe about 6 months into his term before he dies, and his vice president, Millard Fillmore, whom, of course, everyone knows about, takes over. But again, the Whigs' hopeful agenda that they were going to push through, again, is taken over by someone who doesn't share that agenda. And so it's really not until the election, the Whigs disappear by the mid-50s, the Republicans replace it, and then it's with Abraham Lincoln's election that all of a sudden you start seeing these things through. Tyler, interestingly enough, lived a very long life, had a number of children. He was elected to the Confederate Congress, which is a distinction that very few other presidents can claim.
So this is in the mid-1800s, before the Civil War, obviously.
Correct, yeah. So, but he died before he could assume office in the Confederate Congress.
Okay. We're in the 1800s, taking a tour of an exhibit at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, a special edition of River to River. Tom Schwartz, the director here at the museum, showing us around. We're in the mid-1800s. Do you want to keep us there? Or are we going to leap forward too much farther?
Well, since we referenced the Civil War, let's get right to it. So representing Abraham Lincoln, the man who presided over the war, we have his official presidential portfolio. The government issued these to the president and his cabinet members, and it's leather. It's actually kind of a, if we could take it out of the vitrine that it's in and open it up, you would see that it's kind of an accordion fold and that it expands out.
Sort of like a modern-day file folder, but made out of leather here.
Correct, with his name stamped in gold and a gold leaf, and you could see it's well worn, so it got a lot of use. This particular item carried the soldiers that guarded him when he would leave the White House and go up to the soldiers' home outside of Washington frequently saw him carry this around. And we know that that's where he would retreat and where he worked on the drafts of the Emancipation Proclamation. The other really interesting item we have representing Lincoln is, again, his presidential seal. It's an ivory handle that's kind of heavily laden with red sealing wax. And essentially, on letters and documents, he would drip the wax and take the seal and press it on the hot wax, creating the imprint.
And this is just to explain, those who might not know, this is so that when you got an order or information from the president, you knew if it had the presidential seal in wax, that was truly from the president and not an imposter.
Correct. Yeah. Correct, yeah. So, again, this is all very representative of the man because, you know, again, of Lincoln, we think of powerful words. Again, one of those leaders that led us through a time of great crisis. So whereas Washington really had to work to make the system sound, get it on sound footing, you know, based upon those Lockean principles, Lincoln saw his role as trying to preserve that legacy for later generations. And that whole idea of equality of opportunity, the right to rise. Mm-hmm.
From Lincoln, we move on to where are we headed now through this exhibit?
Again, we've been talking about presidents that some are kind of surprise occupants of the White House. For example, John Tyler following the death of William Henry Harrison. With Abraham Lincoln, he is the first president to be assassinated. The person who took over for Lincoln, again, was another individual who was not really a Republican by belief. Andrew Johnson was a Democrat in Tennessee, but he opposed the Confederacy. He was a Unionist. And so when he takes over from Lincoln, he has different ideas about what to do with the freed slaves and the extent of the rights and protections to grant to them. He was trained, apprenticed as a tailor. And so what we have representing Andrew Johnson are these huge shears that he used in order to cut cloth, a very heavy iron, which would be put on a stove and heated, as well as a thimble. You don't usually think of presidents with needle and thread and thimbles, mm-hmm. but
right.
Here we have it. We're representing Andrew Johnson.
Okay. Andrew Johnson, president from 1865. This would be following Lincoln's death to 1869.
And he was, of course, the first president to be impeached. He was one vote shy of actually being booted from office.
All right.
The next interesting item here is the dressing gown of James A. Garfield.
Well, that's really ornate. It's a paisley. I didn't know they had paisley back then, or is that paisley? I'm not sure.
It certainly could be something that Peter Max designed. You know, it is very colorful and very lively in terms of the design. Garfield's father died when he was very young. He was raised by his mother and fought in the war, was a brigadier general, was at terrible battles at Shiloh and Chickamauga, and then became a professional politician. After Lincoln, Garfield was the second president to be assassinated. And so he didn't have much time in office. That time that he had in office, he pushed for civil service reforms, and he was actually killed by a disgruntled office seeker who didn't like the idea of professional qualifications trumping partisan support.
This hour, a visit to the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch for a tour of an exhibit featuring oil paintings and artifacts of all 44 presidents with Tom Schwartz, the museum director. Coming up, we'll finish up with a number of very interesting artifacts: Teddy Roosevelt's horse saddle, Woodrow Wilson's elaborate picnic basket, and Barack Obama's chess set. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, visiting the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch for a tour of an exhibit featuring artifacts from all 44 presidents. And we're going through some of the artifacts, getting the stories behind them from Museum Director Tom Schwartz. When we left off before the break, we were talking about James Garfield. Why do we hear so much, of course, about Lincoln being assassinated, the first president assassinated, and almost nothing, next to nothing, about James Garfield being assassinated?
Part of it was, well, again, Lincoln was killed at the height of his accomplishment. He had just gotten the country through a bloody civil war with military victory, but more importantly, with the goal of ending slavery and beginning to work on the aftermath of how do you integrate these new freed slaves into American society. With Garfield, his was more of a nuts and bolts approach. He was dealing with issues that today, you know, we would like a president to embrace, but it wasn't nearly as dramatic as, you know, coming off of the Civil War at the moment where the Lee had surrendered and it looked like, you know, finally country was going to unify. Garfield did embrace many of Lincoln's beliefs, though, of extending rights and protections to blacks.
Okay, American Presidents is the exhibit at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Tom Schwartz, we're listening to the director give us a tour of what will be on exhibit here at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library until the end of October. Yeah. So we're in the mid, just past the Civil War era. Where would you like to take us now, Tom?
So let's leap ahead and talk about another president who was an accidental president, and that's Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt, we have a horse saddle. And of course, many people know that Theodore Roosevelt was led a group of soldiers in the Spanish-American War up Kettle Hill.
The Rough Riders, of
That's
course.
Right,
we
right.
all know that. Yeah.
What they might not know is that when he was a youngster, he was very sickly. And so he would go out into the Dakotas and work on the big ranches out there in North Dakota. He also went into South Dakota, but there's a ranch that they operated as a historic site in North Dakota. And so he learned to ride. William McKinley's campaign manager, when McKinley was killed, referred to Roosevelt as that damn cowboy. But what you get with Roosevelt is an entirely different approach to the presidency, someone who is larger than life and began the progressive movement, this idea of bringing in experts. And so Roosevelt was had almost this unlimited source of energy. He was a dynamo. He loved interacting with the press. He was constantly holding press conferences. He was always putting, created the term the bully pulpit, using the power of the presidency in order to push through for reforms. Most of us read The Jungle when we were in school about, you know, the meatpacking conditions in Chicago. Roosevelt read it, and he did something about it. You know, he enacted legislation to clean up, to provide safe food. And so with Roosevelt, there was an assassination attempt on Roosevelt himself. The bullet went through his metal eyeglass case, and 50 pages of a speech before it entered his chest. And
isn't this the instance where he gets out and makes a speech afterwards, even though he's been shot? Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. He doesn't go to the hospital until after he delivers the
speech. He insists on giving a speech after being shot.
Yeah. So the eyeglass case with the bullet hole and the speech with the hole, I mean, those have been on display, not here, but elsewhere. And but again, you know, it gives you the sense of who this guy is. I mean, he just seems to be a force of nature.
Right. So this particular saddle we have here of Teddy Roosevelt, is it a favorite saddle? I imagine a man like him would have had several saddles. What do we know about this particular saddle?
So actually, there's this bill of sales. So he bought it. Of course, where else you buy a saddle but New York City, right? But it's actually made by a saddle maker out in Colorado. So, but you do have kind of the bill of sale attached to it, indicating where he bought it.
The exhibit is American Presidents in West Branch through the end of October. So we've entered the beginning of the 19th, the 20th century with Teddy Roosevelt. Where do you want to take us now?
Let's go to Woodrow Wilson, and then we'll jump to a relative of Roosevelt's. Of course, Woodrow Wilson was the one of the few Democrats. With the election of Lincoln, you had this huge span of five decades of almost uninterrupted Republican rule. The one exception was Grover Cleveland, who interrupted it twice, and then Woodrow Wilson.
So to now, Tom Schwartz, you brought us to an artifact that you've brought here that belonged to Woodrow Wilson, who was president beginning in 1913 until 1921. It's a suitcase, and this is a sort of picnic basket?
Yeah. It's not something Yogi Bear would be familiar with because it's not wicker. As you said, it's leather. But it has all sorts of slots for the sterling silver forks and spoons. It has places for thermoses. The plates are actually tin with a baked finish, and has cups in it, and it has even containers where you could put either hot or cold food, and salt and pepper shakers. So it's you could really create a rather elaborate meal or simple sandwiches with it.
All right. We'll try to put a picture. We'll put a picture of that on our website as well. It's best to see it in person here at the Herbert Hoover Library and Museum. But if you can't, have a look at our website.
So next, we talked about Theodore Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt was the only president to actually serve four terms. He died very early into the fourth term. But he not only created National Archives and Records Administration Presidential Library Museum system by creating his own in Hyde Park. He was a collector of stamps, a philately. And
that is the technical term for stamp collecting?
Yes. Yes.
Say that again.
Philately.
Philately. That's a fun word. Okay.
You could see some of the items from his stamp collection, their first day covers. And as well as his magnifying glass. The other kind of collecting interest of Roosevelt were lithographs and of sailing vessels. And, of course, he served as the Assistant Secretary of the Navy under Woodrow Wilson. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now we're standing in front of another vitrine here. We've definitely jumped into more modern times with this telephone system. Very, very impressive telephone outlay. Who did this belong to?
So anyone who has been to Texas, to either the Johnson Museum, but more importantly to the ranch, which is maybe an hour outside of Austin, they'll immediately get the significance of this. Lyndon Johnson was known for the way that he would cajole and browbeat members of Congress into supporting and passing his legislation. He was always on the phone. Every room of his ranch at least has one phone. Some rooms have two or three. And in the dining room, on the big table, by his seat, hidden by the edge of the table, is a phone. Johnson felt he needed to be in contact with people at a moment's notice, at any time, in any place. And so they still had the hidden recording system in the White House. And so you can go to the Johnson Presidential Library Museum website and listen to, they have turned all of the phone conversations into MP3 files. And so you can listen to the conversations he's had with members of his cabinet, with world leaders, with Mrs. Kennedy after the assassination. More than any other president, the phone is pretty much a good representation of Johnson.
Okay, Tom, now we've come to a different showcase here. This one has footwear mainly in it, a pair of jogging shoes and a pair of cowboy boots. We've got some baseball cards. Who did these belong to?
So you have the cowboy boots with the golf cleats belong to George Herbert Walker Bush. They were given to him by the U.S. Secret Service, which is, of course, what any Texan would wear out on the golf course, right? He was followed by Bill Clinton, and Clinton was famously known early in the administration for his morning jogs, which often would end at a McDonald's where he'd pick up some fast food to eat, which seemed to negate, you know, the benefit of running. The work gloves actually came from Ronald Reagan. And, of course, there are many clips. Reagan liked news organizations to come and show him working on his ranch. And he'd be kind of chopping wood and clearing brush. And he knew that the Secret Service had a post mounted on a hill. And so one morning he came out and it looked like he was stretching, and then he clutched his chest and leaned over, and immediately the Secret Service was there, and he stood up and he laughed and he waved. So
he was just testing.
He was just testing. And the baseball cards are interesting because the George W. Bush, the son of George Herbert Walker Bush, as a kid, would send the cards to the different players and ask if they would autograph and send it back. And so we have about six different players here, including Mickey Mantle, who accommodated him by signing the card and sending it back. And then, of course, when he became an adult, he owned a baseball team.
Okay, we've come to... Number 44, President Obama, and an artifact from his presidency, a chess set that, unlike anyone I've seen before. Of course, it has the pattern of a chess set, but the players are quite unusual. Tell us about it.
The chessboard itself is made up of lots of very small inlay that is a mosaic. and so because it comes from the Middle East, it was given by the King of Jordan to President Obama. If you think about walking into one of kind of the ancient temples and having inlay floors, that's the chessboard is made up of white and black squares, but each square made up of these small pieces of stone. And then the chess pieces themselves, the pawns kind of look like Hershey's Kisses without the foil.
The cone shape, yeah.
It's a cone shape. And then again, on the king and queen, the rooks, the bishops, they are, again, very modern and geometric, but also having inlay, which kind of highlight or accentuate each one of the pieces.
It looks like an inlay of something like mother of pearl or something.
Yes, yeah. So, you know, the pawns are very basic, black and white wood, but the other pieces are much more elaborate.
As I look down at a little bit of information on this chess set, you can see that it was given to President Obama in February of 2016. So that's a recent acquisition that you have here.
What most people don't realize is that the gifts given to the president during their term of office, as well as the papers they generate, by law, belong to the National Archives and Records Administration. And so because of the transition period that occurred when we were working on the planning of this, we had to deal with the Presidential Materials Division in the National Archives. They had to make sure that when they sent the material out to the Hoffman Estates temporary facility, which have President Obama's artifacts and papers, that this would be easy to get to. And so, again, it's all of that advanced planning. Because they knew ahead of time that we wanted something, they identified it, they kept it in a separate crate so that they could easily retrieve it for us when we went to go pick it up.
So, Tom, as part of this exhibit, perhaps explain to us the videos that we have playing on two different walls here. I think that's Herbert Hoover I'm seeing right now.
Herbert Hoover with King Tut and feeding him from the table, which you shouldn't never do.
King Tut, his dog.
His dog. But what we've also provide are a number of the Color Home movies that we released the end of March, actually on Lou's birthday on March 29th. And what makes these home movies important, and they're the first color home movies taken of a president, but also of the White House grounds, and many by the First Lady. So kind of neat. So this is a particular clip is showing Hoover as president-elect fishing off the coast of Florida. I think he catches a barracuda here. He also, in a later portion, catches a sailfish. So
that's really unique. You do not, I mean, going back to the 1930s, you do not connect that era in documentation with colored photos or colored film. But here we have full-color film of Herbert Hoover catching, ooh, look at that. It is a big barracuda.
Yeah. And what made it deceptive was that the film itself, if visual appearance, looks black and white, but it has lines. And you needed a special projector which had a special lens which would refract the light to bring out the color in the film. Well, they haven't made those projectors for well over 60 years. And so... And it went, Kodak quit making Kodak color film and replaced it with the very popular Kodak chrome film by 1936. So it had a very short shelf life. It was introduced in the end of 1928 and pretty much disappeared by 1936. Mm-hmm. So what this also tells us, though, is that Lou, Henry Hoover, was an early adapter of this new technology and color home movies, so which doesn't surprise anyone who's studied Mrs. Hoover.
So, Tom Schwartz, as we conclude this little radio tour of the latest exhibit at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, we have piqued everybody's interest in coming out here to West Branch to see it here. But I'm wondering, from you as a director who, along with many others, have worked to put this exhibition together with the many artifacts, what do you hope Iowans, Midwesterners, anybody who comes here goes away with after taking in 44 presidents, oil portraits, and some of their very personal artifacts?
Yeah. So what we're trying to get across here are not the partisan politics, but rather what these individuals who held the office, what they were like as people. The fact of putting the artifacts in this to in some way reflect a portion of their personality, what made them unique and why they're not all the same. It wasn't merely the events that defined them, but also how they defined events through their own personalities and life experiences. And so the presidency is the highest office in the land. People say the most powerful person in the world. But I think anyone coming through this exhibit will see that tempered simply by knowing more about them as people, as husbands, as fathers, and
as stamp collectors,
as human beings. Yeah.
Excellent. Tom Schwartz, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Tom Schwartz, director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, giving us a tour of an exhibit through the end of October featuring oil paintings, but we were focusing on artifacts from all 44 presidents that you can see in West Branch. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.